not only to what is presented on screen and so, but also by what they read about Elizabeth Taylor and the other heroes of this kind of thing. Is this not a real problem? Was there not a certain a truth in the older view that acting, while being a tolerable entertainment, is not as a profession too highly as to be esteemed? And is not the present esteem partly to simply, well, of course this is in itself a consequence to the enormous income of these people, which enables them to live as they list, and so on and so on. Well, these are the kind of questions which I think one must raise, and they are bound to have a great social effects, these changes. And the present day view, including social science methodology, simply prevents one from giving a diagnosis of the effects of present day society. I mean, the social science methodology, by the simple reason that value judgments as such are subjective. Yeah? I mean, therefore, they have nothing to do in science proper. But apart from that, the insufficient understanding of other forms of human life, or to speak empirically, of older forms of life, of which we have been spoken. Now, I would think we should now turn to the larger problem to which I have referred more than once, and that is what Cicero says in the Officers. The last word from Cicero's own point of view on this subject. Now, we have discussed briefly last time the term used of vicium, which is mostly used in this book as a translation of the Greek term kathaikon, the appropriate. And this kathaikon, as distinguished from, again, the Greek term katorthoma, it means the kathaikon is that which is proper. The katorthoma means that what is right. In other words, to make it clear, the officium, duty, as he understood, is what is proper and possible for a non-wise man. But there is another notion of other rules which belong to the wise as wise. The chief passage, I repeat this, is in the third book of De Finibus, paragraph 58-59. Cicero, writing to his young son, takes this popular morality. But what is the morality of the wise man? More precisely, what does it mean truly to follow nature? The moral man is described here is perhaps not simply the man who follows nature. Now let us turn to a few passages in which this is discussed. The first is in paragraph 126.
Back to the Ophidius.
In the first book of the Ophidius, yeah. Do you have the De Finibus, Lucio?
Yes.
Well, I don't have it here, but the sentence I have in mind is where Rackham, or I'm sure not Rackham, but the proofreader, omitted the crucial word, yeah? I mean, when he says the kathotoma, morality and of the wise, requires that a justly deposited deposit must be rendered, whereas the appropriate, the duty in the common sense, is to render any deposit. So that this reflection, justly deposited or not, is no longer considered. We have a crude rule of thumb, which is defensible as a rule of thumb, but is not more than that. A wise man, if he could follow wisdom, would take into consideration whether what is deposited with him is justly deposited. And in the last analysis, never let us forget that, What does it mean? Just is a positive, meaning it must at least be the just property of the depositor. Yeah? I mean, it must be his property. Yeah, but can you leave it at that, according to the strict view of wisdom? The public book wants Scipio's teaching. What is property? True property. Property according to nature. Only that can be truly property of a man, what he can use to bear of his remuneration. After all, he doesn't teach for nothing. All others teach, but we see here also that Protagoras too needs the gods. How can he get his money in dubious cases if these pupils do not take seriously an oath? Well, at any rate, be it evil, be it for only for this low reason, we can be sure that Protagoras will not teach impiety. That would be the surest road of losing money. This much is clear. Yeah, but this passage is particularly interesting for the following reason, because he says that Protagoras teaches virtue in a most competent manner, and so to say the peak and cream of virtue for money. But we have been told that everyone teaches money, teaches virtue gratis. Everyone says to everybody else all the time, be virtuous. Now, why do the other people teach it without payment, and Protagoras teaches it for payment? Protagoras has no exaggerated notion of human unselfishness. The others teach virtue because, and justice, because they derive benefit from it. In 327b, if we can return to that for one moment.
For all of us profit from each other's justice and virtue.
Yeah, that's it.
And
here is a very interesting thing. He says us, yeah? In your reading. Mm-hmm. The manuscript reading is you in the plural. Us is a correction by the first editor of Plato, Stephanus. That's quite interesting. You, of course, teach virtue gratis because you are benefited by it. But I am not benefited by if the Athenians become more just. I therefore must get a remuneration. So I believe here the old, although Stephanus was a very respectable editor, very respectable, I prefer the manuscript reading on this ground. And did you get the point? The justice and virtue of one another is useful to you in the plural. And therefore, naturally, you teach it greatly. But it is not useful to me. Today I'm in Athens, tomorrow I'm in another city, and I must get a remuneration. To say nothing of the fact that I teach it for much more better and much more competently than the others do. Yes, good. Now we are not yet finished with the speech of Protagoras next 328c3. It's Logos, yeah, Mython Kai Logos, yeah. Yes?
And such is the argument, Logos, by which I endeavor to show that virtue may be taught, and that this is the opinion of the Athenians. And I have also attempted to show that you are not to wonder at good fathers having bad sons, or at good sons having bad fathers. The sons of Polycletus, who are the companions of
Polycletus, a famous sculptor. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Who are the companions of our two friends here, Paralus and Xanthippus, afford an example of this. they are insignificant in comparison with their father. And this is true with the sons of many other artists. And yet I ought not to say the same of Paralis and Xanthippus themselves, for they are young, and there is still hope for them.
Yeah. Now he has shown that his view regarding the teachability of virtue agrees with the Athenian view. So he is saved. And that the case of the inferior sons is not as hopeless as Socrates had asserted, because they are still young. In the practical cases here, you know. Well, in summary, that this end, for there are still hopes in them, for they are young. That's the last word. It's a proper ending for this being. Hope, altogether a bright picture. We can also say he defends both the fathers and the sons against Socrates' implicit structure. He has the best of all worlds, or as one can also say, he eats a cake and has it. Now this will become clear in the sequel. Good. That was a terrific speech. I mean, and we, of course, by our splitting it up, by reading step by step, have not experienced the full impact of the speech. For this reason, it would have to be done in a perfect translation, which I'm sure does not exist, but which could be made, or almost perfect translation, and be read by a man trained in all the arts of elocution and rhetoric, then we would be duly impressed. So we have to make an effort of our imagination to recover what the feat or the enjoyment which the people present have had. Now let us go on immediately. Yes?
Protagoras finished his tour de force and came to the end of his...
No, that's not good. Protagoras, having shown off so many and such like things, stopped the speech. Now, this so many, the quantity, Protagoras' speech is unusually long for such an occasion. The long speech of Callicles in the Gorgias, the long speeches of Glaucon and Adimantos at the beginning of the second book of the Republic are roughly half as long as this speech. And the speeches here indicate to be an epideixis, exhibition. That is one kind of rhetoric which, according to Aristotle in his rhetoric, has the purpose of showing the power of the speaker. There is a forensic speech, for example, does not have the primary purpose of showing the power of the speaker, but to get an acquittal, or for that matter, condemnation. And it also has, the forensic speech has at its end the beautiful, whereas a forensic speech, the just, and the deliberative speech, the expedient. Now, this is a speech of this kind. It is surely a tour de force is a tolerable paraphrase, but it is a big show, a marvelous show to which we have been entertained. Yes, now begin again, Mr. Duncan.
Protagoras, having shown off so many and such wise things,
so
he said...
Not wise, did such say, like.
Oh, such like, you misread. Such like things, came to the end of it, and in my ear so charming left his voice that I the while thought him still speaking, still stood fixed to hear. At length, when the truth dawned upon me that he had really finished, not without difficulty, I began to collect myself.
Here, let us stop here for a moment. You see,
This is, shows, of course, again the virtue of a narrated dialogue. Socrates could not very well have told to Protagoras in this way how this speech had affected him. Yeah, that's clear. And I think it is, the description is very clear. He still was waiting. This cannot finish, this beauty. It cannot finish, but it finished. I once heard a speaker, a very famous man in this country, that's the reason I cannot mention his name, who was supposed to give a speech on the atomic bomb. He had no knowledge of physics or technology, but he started, say, at 8:05, without any note. He made a speech covering the whole ground marvelously, and at 9:00, without any preparation, but something in him, it stopped, and it stopped absolutely when it was the right kind of moment for stopping. This kind of thing can be done, as you see. Here there was, of course, no time limit. He could have gone on, but so that, and it took him some time. When he says, but when I observed that he had in fact finished, because it is unbelievable that this fountain should ever stop. And then he had to put himself together, yeah, and come back to reality. And then he said something. What did he say?
Looking at Hippocrates, I said to him, O son of Apollodorus, how deeply grateful I am to you for having brought me hither. I would not have missed the speech of Protagoras for a great deal.
Yes. So we know about, we are told again what we know already, that none other than this son of Apollodorus, Hippocrates, is responsible for the whole dialogue. The whole dialogue is for the sake of Hippocrates, to give him a somewhat better basis for judgment of whether it is wise to become a pupil of Protagoras. This implies, as we have seen from other opportunities, Socrates knows Protagoras a long time. But he did not yet know how Protagoras would handle such a situation, how he would talk with a view to Hippocrates or his like. And that was quite an experience, as they say. And now the next point.
For I used to imagine that no human care could make men good, but I know better now.
Yeah, now I'm convinced of his way. Socrates has been charmed into believing that virtue is teachable, i.e. that virtue is of human origin. He showed that he has understood the myth perfectly. If you remember the myth, it was said it was a gift of Zeus. That, of course, was merely mythical, and a mythical expression for social pressure. Socrates' previous view then was that virtue cannot be produced by human agency, and that means that it arises either by divine apportionment, thea moira, or by nature. But we have to think for one moment, is this truly the Socratic Platonic teaching? We cannot separate the two conveniently. Is there not another kind of virtue apart from that? I mean, is there not, according to Socrates, a kind of virtue which is produced by human agency? Well, some of you must know from former discussions. Then I read you one passage from the 10th book of Plato's Republic, 619 B and C. The situation is how people after their death choose a lot for the next life. When the prophet had thus spoken, he said that the drawer of the first lot at once sprang to seize the greatest tyranny, and that in his folly and greed he chose it without sufficient examination, and failed to observe that it involved the fate of eating his own children and other horrors. And then when he inspected it at leisure, he beat his breast and bewailed his choice, not abiding by the forewarning of the prophet, who had told them, be careful. For he did not blame himself for his woes, but fortune and the gods and anything except himself. He was one of those who had come down from heaven, in other words, who had led a former life nobly. A man who had lived in a well-ordered polity in his former life, participating in virtue by habit and not by philosophy. There is a virtue, let me see, participated in virtue by habituation without philosophy. There is a kind of virtue which is due entirely to habituation, to that, or to that social pressure of which Protagoras speaks, without philosophy. And from Plato's strict point of view, the genuine virtue is possible only on the basis of philosophy. What he calls he has another term for that occurring in the Phaedo, among other dialogues, vulgar virtue or political virtue, and that means the one which is brought about by social pressure, by threats of punishment, or maybe also by the cannot, not only by the stick. That's not genuine virtue. This. For in Plato there is no moral virtue in the Aristotelian sense. This is, I think, crucially for one to understand Plato. What Aristotle calls moral virtue would be in between the stick and carrot virtue spoken of by Plato and the true virtue which is possible only on the basis of philosophy. This in between, the virtue of the gentleman, the non-philosophic gentleman, does not exist in Plato. It's for Plato an ambiguous phenomenon, we may say, which has not the dignity which it has according to us. This is crucial. So in other words, what Protagoras says about virtue is not altogether wrong from Socrates or Plato's point of view. It is only the error consists in the fact that he is silent about the other kind of virtue, as I mentioned possibly. But that there is such a thing as a socially induced virtue, meant in today's lingo by such terms as well-adjusted people, for example. Where the question is completely open, to what are you adjusted? For example, if a child has the misfortune of being born in a house of ill repute and cannot, when he or she comes to some understanding, well adjust to this environment, if this is a better child, I would assume, than a child that excellently adjusts. So if you speak of adjustment, one must always say adjustment to what? But within crude, for certain crude contexts, like those of psychiatry, for example, it may be sufficient to leave it simply at the question, adjusted or not adjusted, a functioning cog or a non-functioning cog. But this is, of course, not sufficient for a deeper understanding of human affairs. Yes.
Well, wouldn't the philosophic virtue be teachable as well? In a certain sense, Socrates would be teaching virtue.
But Socrates always denies that he teaches virtue. That we must leave, that we cannot, let us, we have enough to do to understand this provisional question, which is discussed here. What about the crudest and lowest and in a way sham form of virtue, which is of tremendous practical importance? Because when we speak ordinarily of nice people, we are not, I mean, perhaps including ourselves in that, we are not very strict. You know, people who have never have been to jail, perhaps never even have been before a law court, and some other things that is compatible with all kinds of deeper diseases, as is not hard to understand. Good. So what I said, at any rate, is now, that is clear, he has come here for, yeah, Socrates is convinced now. He knows now that virtue is teachable. Good. But the question is, of course, what virtue? We shall see that. Yes?
Yet I have still one very small difficulty, which I am sure Protagoras will easily explain, as he has already explained so much.
He will teach it fully and explain it fully in addition to what he had done before. A man who has overcome such difficulty will be able to overcome this tiny little bit. Yes?
If a man were to go and consult Pericles, or any of our great speakers, about these matters, he might perhaps hear as fine a discourse. But then, when one has a question to ask of any of them, like books, they can neither answer nor ask. And if anyone challenges the least particular of their speech, they go ringing on in a long harangue, like brazen pots, which, when they are struck, continue to sound unless someone puts his hand upon them. Whereas
you see a Socrates irony in the sense in which everyone observes it. Fundamentally, Socrates speaks always ironically in the strict sense that he always speaks with a view to the individual or individuals to whom he speaks. That is the deepest meaning of irony in Plato's language. But in the crude sense, you know, when we say somebody speaks ironically, he of course also does this from time to time, and this is clear irony. Only one tiny little bit of a thing which proves to be fatal to the whole thing. And secondly, that he compels Protagoras by flattering him to give short replies. You are such a terrific man and you claim that, so that's it. But he says, however, also one in this flattery, there is also a severe criticism. Your show of speech, which charmed me, belongs to the kind of things which in a pinch even Pericles could have done, someone who does not trace did a New York man. Rhetoric, public speech, books. That belongs together. And they all have this quality that they do not answer new questions. But we must not forget, of course, that laws also are such writings which need the living human mind in order to become alive. So that laws too are a problem. Yes?
Whereas our friend Protagoras...
Our friends, of course. This Protagoras here. No, they were not so sentimental. Yeah.
Whereas Protagoras here cannot only make a good long speech, as he has already shown.
Long and beautiful speech.
long and beautiful speech, as he has already shown, but when he is asked a question, he can answer briefly. And when he asks, he will wait and hear the answer. And yeah. This is a very rare gift.
Almost like good doggy. Yes. Now, just as Socrates compelled Protagoras to defend his orthodoxy by warning him that the Athenian Jews might be different, he now compels him to defend his reputation as a short answerer by giving short answers. And you will see Protagoras will not merely answer questions, but he will also raise questions. Namely, in case Socrates' question, for example, is not clear enough, he will ask, well, how do you mean it? And so, but perhaps more than that. Yes.
Now, I, Protagoras, want to ask of you a little question, which, if you will only answer, I shall be quite satisfied. You were saying that virtue can be taught. That I will take upon your authority, and there is no one to whom I am more ready to trust.
And this I would believe, if I ever would believe any human being, I would believe you. I will believe you. So you see, Socrates makes now quite clear, contrary to what he had said in 328e, that Protagoras has not convinced him of the teachability of virtue. And he has not convinced him, we can assume, because of that little point connected, which he will bring up now. That is the root of the difficulty. Yes?
But I marvel at one thing about which I should like to have my mind set at rest. You were speaking of Zeus sending justice and reverence to men. And several times while you were speaking,
you know,
just...
Also many times in the speeches. This implies, this means what he said about Zeus was not said in the speeches but in the myth, as we know. The reference to the poor. Yeah? Important. Yeah?
And many times in the logos.
Yeah.
In the speeches, justice and self-control and moderation and piety, and all these qualities were described by you as if they could be lumped together into one thing, namely virtue. Now I want you to tell me exactly whether virtue is one whole of which justice and moderation and piety are parts, or whether all these are only the names of one and the same thing. That is the doubt which still lingers in my mind.
So, now, he alludes here, at the beginning of this passage, to Protagoras' admission in the myth that virtue is of divine origin. You see, that Zeus sends these things, not you to human agency. And he reminds us of the difference between the myth and the logos. He used here logoi because it consists of three parts. In these logoi, Protagoras had spoken, and not in the myth, Protagoras had spoken of virtue as one. Quite a few times he had done this. Now, the little point which he has is this. Is virtue simply one? Or does it have parts? Why is this such a terribly important question for reasonable, commonsensical men? I mean, we must not, on the basis of what we know from other Platonic dialogues, if not from histories of philosophy, give an answer to that question. That would be absurd. We must consider the situation in which everyone present is. Would this be the greatest difficulty for anyone who had heard this Protagoras speech? To make the difficulty quite clear, I will use an extreme expression. I will say that the question of the unity of virtue is at this point a kind of red herring. But nevertheless, the question of the unity of virtue is the question in an entirely different way as Socrates states it here. We all must have been impressed by the fact that Protagoras spoke almost all the time of virtue in at least two very different senses. The virtue expected of every human being, man or woman, adult or child, free man or slave. And on the other hand, of a virtue like that of Pericles, the virtue of the great statesman. Well, if we are more precise, we would say there is even a still higher kind of virtue came to sight for one moment, the virtue of these legislators of old, which is still greater than that of Pericles. Now, are these all, is this the same virtue? Or are these two, are these different virtues? And also the question of, needless to say that this is linked up with the question of the rich and the poor. Are the rich capable of a kind of virtue of which the poor are incapable? Or more importantly, are the gifted ones capable of virtues of which the ungifted ones are not capable? This is the most obvious question when one reads a speech, the long speech. And that is indeed a question of the unity of virtue. Does virtue, in the case of any human being, mean the same, or are there various levels or kinds of virtue? Socrates, for reasons which we can perhaps find out, takes the question of the unity of virtue, but understands it in this precise sense, for example, justice and piety identical or non-identical, and that will be the subject of the secret. Yeah, there are many more subjects which we which come up in this particular case, in this particular book. As one of them, I mentioned the problem of universal society. Do you remember, Mr. Jack, what he says about that?
I had a question.
Pardon?
Going to this other that I wanted to bring up. I had a question in the
Please.
Problem.
Yeah.
This distinction, a lot of numbers were puzzled. Cicero uses the word honestum and also the word virtus.
Virtus. Which was the other word you mentioned?
Oh, honestum.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Now,
that's very simple.
Different?
That's very simple. Virtus, as used by Cicero, yeah, whatever the original Rome, well, it is derived from the word vir. And virtus means, therefore, in itself, manliness, like the Greek andrea. Yeah? But by Cicero's time, and in Cicero's usage, virtus is simply used as a translation for the Greek arete, and therefore simply means what we traditionally mean by virtue, yeah? The excellence of man, and especially the moral excellence of man. Yeah? Good. Now, honestum is the Latin for the Greek word kalon, but not kalon in the sense of the beautiful, because that is expressed in Latin by pulchro, but by kalon in the sense of the fair or noble, the honorable. That today when we speak in English of honest, and not only today, but already in Hobbes' time at the latest, honest did no longer mean honorable. I forgot now the precise formulation of Hobbes, I've quoted somewhere, In Hobbes's time, honest and honorable were used along class lines. The honorable for the gentleman, the honest for the non-gentleman. Yeah? Just as we say, an honest blacksmith, yeah? Whereas a knight would be his, that would be called honorable, but his one. Now, in Cicero, that different distinction does not exist. The honestum is the honorable. Yeah, just like the Greek talon, the fair, the resplendent, in the Greek usage, in the classical usage, what we call moral today, would have to be called ton dikaion kai ton kalon, the right or just, and the noble. And the distinction is not unimportant, because what we mean by duty today, in ordinary meaning, is the right or just. The noble is something more resplendent than that to which we are strictly speaking obliged, as we say, above and beyond the call of duty, yeah? But not limited to that. And that is the noble. And that is the reason for the distinction are very important. For example, the most important example, which we discussed last time when we read the last quarter, we read the laws. To undergo punishment if you have committed a crime is just. Yeah? But it can under no circumstances be called noble, because no one is admired for undergoing punishment. Or if you pay your debts, you act justly. But you cannot possibly be called noble for that. You merely do your duty. Yeah? The fact that the Greeks have this distinction is not merely an accident of the Greek language. And we have, when Plato discussed the whole problem of punishment in the laws, he refers to that difficulty because that seems to show that whereas according to a certain simple view, everything just is noble, and everything noble is just, the case of punishment clearly shows that this is not simply true. Because, to repeat, when you undergo just punishment, you act justly, but not nobly. And Plato develops, starting from this, a very heterodox doctrine of punishment. By which he is trying to show a noble notion of punishment, namely this way, that undergoing punishment means to be improved. Yeah? Now this is of course something noble. Think if you rise out of the mire of ignorance and then are toward wisdom, that would be noble. But that means, of course, it has very little to do with what we understand by punishment, and in particular curative institutions, which do not strike us as so much devoted to the elevation of man. Yeah? Good. Now, in Cicero usage, as I say, honestum is simply, I would take as a Latin translation of calon, and translate it by honorable. And not by honest, that would be too narrow. You know, in honesty we think especially of deception, of this, I mean, Guinness has something to do with deception and lying and this kind of thing, as you can easily see from the fact that you are not in the habit of calling a man who murdered another man that he is dishonest, whereas of a fraud or liar you would say is dishonest. And honest is, in other words, now a very narrow meaning, and in Cicero it has a rich meaning of the Greek kalon. Therefore, I would translate it by noble or honorable. And since virtue is a habit of doing only honorable things, virtue and honesto are inseparable.
Where does this mean,
virtus? Virtus is a habit of doing only honesta, only honorable things. Yeah, that's the relation. So it could very well have been, I mean, if Cicero had wanted to coin a new word, of which I do not, by the way, I do not know at the moment whether it was new at that time, He could also have said virtuoso. Yeah.
He's the only one they list that used the adjective.
Yeah, yeah, sure. No. But I'm sure that virtuoso would, if it existed at all in Cicero, which I do not know, a glance at the dictionary would settle that. And then virtuoso probably had a different meaning. Just, you know, traditionally a virtuoso is a man who has a very special virtue, say that of a piano player or whatever it may be, and does not have the meaning of virtues in the physics. This is a
secret. I was wondering, you know, as Cicero uses the word honestum in this book, or in this whole work, especially in conjunction, it seems to me, you are quite often in connection with utile, or
yeah.
And that this hasn't had any connection with what I guess is a later distinction as regards the volume of honestum.
Yes, sure. That's yeah, that is even in Aristotle. The kalon is honesto. The ophelemon is useful. And the difference is, as you, what is the difference that you know? What is the difference?
The bon honesto is love for the sake of itself,
and it's useful, yeah, for example, a chair. Is regarded good only with a view to something else. But a noble action is esteemed for its own sake. Yeah.
This is some sense of, could you discuss the relation between the wise and the noble? Is the wise man necessarily noble? Is the noble man necessarily wise?
Yeah, that is a long question. We would have to study the passages regarding the two lives. Yeah, the theoretical and practical life. And that is in the end in paragraphs 152 to 158. I make this suggestion because it is a bit late and it is also extremely humid today, and therefore I would like to so that we, before we hear the paper of Mr. Sassine, we discuss, or we may do this in addition. You do it. Will you please take into consideration paragraphs 152 to 59?
I did.
You did it, yes, I said. Uh-huh. Good. Then we hear your paper first and have the discussion. Yeah, that is you find frequently such expressions in Greek authors. Sophon, a kalon, yeah, a something else. In other words, there is something which is wise, and then there is something which is noble. That clearly shows that the meaning of the two terms is different. There may be something wise without being noble. And that doesn't mean that it must be ignoble, but simply, for example, what is a very clever conceit in the 16th century meaning of the term. Concetto. A very clear, that is something, you know, something has figured out something very brilliant, that is wise, but it is not in itself noble. Yeah? And something may be very noble and has nothing to do with any wisdom, a heroic deed for which no knowledge or wisdom of any special kind is required would be noble without being wise. Now the question is then, yeah, but that is only provisional, it's on the first level. Now, if we ascend, then we would come to the question, is the life of the wise man, how is this related to nobility? You find a very detailed discussion of that at the end of Aristotle's Eudemian Ethics, and not in the Commandment, because there the question, following question is raised. As the Greeks said, what we translate usually by the perfect gentleman is literally translated the man who is noble and good, fair and good. In other words, he is guided by a consideration of such good things as identical with the noble. Okay? We can say that. It's the perfect gentleman. But what about the wise man? Aristotle makes there a distinction preparatory everything else, between the kalos kakatos, between the man who is the perfect gentleman, and the aneagatos, the good man, a distinction. Now the good man is a man who chooses, who is nothing but a good calculator. He is not guided by any considerations of the noble or resplendent. And as an example, he gives the Spartans, who were not perfect gentlemen, but who were only good men. And then at the end, he raises the question of the philosopher. And he states the issue as follows. What is the highest goal which man can possibly have? And then he says, to know God. But this end cannot be reached without living. And so we need, therefore, all kinds of deliberations which enable us to know. This deliberation is of a purely calculating character. What enables me to lead that life? In this consideration, there is only the last goal, knowledge of the highest knowledge, and a purely a deliberation as to what I, situated in this particular circumstances, or what would enable me, situated in this particular circumstances, to devote myself to knowledge to the highest degree. Now here in this presentation, the noble as noble doesn't enter. But then there is of course also the other view, which Aristotle also states, and more clearly perhaps Plato, and that is that's a full coincidence of the good and the noble is possible only in the life of contemplation. So that to Aristotle, Kaito, Callistotle includes. But this is, one would have to go into another question, because there is a certain kinship also between the kalon, the noble, beautiful, and the pleasant. For example, when you read the chapter in the Rhetoric, in the first book of the Rhetoric, there is a chapter on the noble or on Tokalon, the noble. And there you will see one meaning of Kalon is really a certain kind of the pleasant. For example, say a beautiful flower and its smell. That is beautiful. In both for the sight and for the smell, and that is also color. Now therefore the question could also be stated as follows, and that is clearer, and that only in, according to Plato and Aristotle, only in the theoretical life is there the good in the highest degree and the pleasant in the highest degree, whereas in the political life there may be the good in the highest degree, but it cannot have this intrinsic rewardingness, if you can call it that way, the present. Yeah, I'm sorry we have to stop here. The reasons are obvious.